discussion of peace and justice issues. And I want to review a little bit the four stances held by Lutherans, four traditional stances. If you still have, I think this was a green piece of paper, if I remember, or whatever color it was, four war peace positions: pacifism, justifiable war, both of which have biblical basis; passivism, a word coined by Chuck Lutz of ALC Church and Society office, meaning we simply, most Lutherans are simply passive, apathetic. They think we don't have, we don't really know what's going on, so we have to leave decisions of war and militarism up to the government, who certainly knows much more than we. And then the holy war, or the crusades, which also has no biblical basis. We hear that now, kill a commie for Christ, or God is on our side. We have to help God defeat the godless enemy. And I think sometimes our administration comes very close to saying this when they say that, when Reagan makes the statement that the embodiment of all evil is found within the Russian Communist Party, or whatever that statement was. Tom brought John a new book that John Howard Yoder just wrote. Augsburg published it, When War is Unjust, Being Honest in Just War Thinking. Now, you know Yoder is a Mennonite pacifist. When he was at Holden last summer, he taught the justifiable war criteria to us, knows it better than most Lutherans and probably most Protestants. His book, Politics of Jesus, he says, is a rebound of a pacifist, that we don't take pacifism seriously in the Protestant church. And so Yoder says, if you're going to have a justifiable war criteria, I think you also ought to take it very seriously. And so he does, I think, a very good job. I have scanned it. I haven't read it carefully, but shows the historical tradition and then how it has evolved, and doesn't come down with a pacifist position, but just really begs us, if this is our criteria, those seven criteria that we put up on the board, then let's take a good look at it and see if there's any possibility that those criteria can hold in a nuclear age, when war is unjust. It's not in the bookstore yet, but I hope that Carla, who's going to be taking over the bookstore, will order it. By the way, this book is dedicated to his brothers and sisters in the Order of St. Martin, so it's extra special for us. Now, a while back, I read an article by John Howard Yoder, which really, it struck me as something that we need to hear in the Lutheran Church, and I just want to take a couple of minutes to read you. It's quite short. It was called A New Look at the Just War Tradition and discussed the criteria of the Christian involvement in war. And then he writes, if the church is to tell its members with any seriousness that they should not engage in an unjust war, they will need to teach their members what makes a war unjust. Okay, I asked you last time we got together, how many of you could name the justifiable war criteria? I think Bill was the only one that thought he could. Maybe some of you came up with one or two, but most of us are not even aware of how the Lutheran Church officially stands on the issue. Catechism or lay education will need to include such matters just as much as the churches now include instruction regarding sexual morality or truth-telling. If Christians are to be in a position to know when it is their duty to disobey an unjust government order, they will need a source of information about the facts of the case. They cannot count on the government to produce the objective information which enables such an evaluation to take in account both sides, right? Makes good sense. Okay. Christian churches will then need to have their own sources of expertise to enable civil resistance to have a genuine factual basis. We just take Romans 13, and we're told to obey the government, and for anybody like Lutheran Peace Fellowship to suggest to the Lutheran Church that sometimes it is right that we disobey our government, whether it is refusing to pay our war taxes or refusing to be part of an armed conflict by being a CO, we just don't give our people any kind of criteria or much education about it at all. Most importantly, if Christians are to consider it as normal or even conceivable that they should disobey their government at given times, then the very idea would need to be rehearsed and digested by many who have assumed that patriotism and religion walk hand in hand. The inability of most Christians to think of themselves as ever disobeying orders goes far deeper than their fear of being punished. It is rather that a part of their identity is bound up with rule-keeping and social conformity. For many Christians, religion is regarded as direct sanction of national ideology. For the first time, it seems to me, people find themselves talking about obeying Christ rather than the government and taking the Sermon on the Mount seriously. Yet they have not had to calculate what the cost would be or whether there exists community resources to stand firmly over long periods of ineffectiveness or even suffering. In other words, the test of the seriousness of the nuclear pacifist is still to come. That's from an essay called A New Look at the Just War Tradition, but my guess is that it's someplace in this book, because this is a series of sermons and essays and lectures that he has given at other parts. So I don't think we need to apologize for the fact that we do, or at least I would like to see in the Christian church, more education on the fact that peacemaking is a faith issue. And as I said, the first session prior to the problem of the ALC synods in convention, or the districts in convention, was that half of the delegates seem to think that peacemaking is a faith issue, and the other half do not think that it is. And somehow or other, I think we have to see peacemaking at the very core of how we live out the gospel of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." He said nothing about blessed it is to be a peace lover. And this really hits home to me. I mean, I love peace. There is nobody that wants war. But the fact of the matter is, we are not called to be peace lovers. We are called to do something about making peace happen. Now, there is a great inconsistency in Lutherans. I think Lutherans bring to the Christian tradition one very beautiful thing, and that is that we are saved by faith, not by our works. Grace and faith, I mean, that's kind of, it's Presbyterian and Roman Catholic too, but I think Lutherans especially always are holding that up, that there is nothing that we can do to earn our salvation. But when it comes to our security, our earthly security, somehow or other we think, God, you don't understand, you know, you really aren't paying attention, and therefore I have to be doing something about this. We have to build bombs to defend ourselves, instead of relying on the God of history. To me, to say, God, I'm going to trust you for my salvation in all aspects of life, is tremendously freeing. I know you've heard this a million times at Holden, but if you're just new to the village, we have two words that we use a lot. One is effectiveness. And what's the other one? Faithfulness. Okay. We are called to be faithful to what Jesus says. We are not called to be effective. We are not called to make history turn out right. And that is a tremendous burden lifted off our shoulders, to know that we simply have to discover what faithfulness is in our own life, what the gospel of Jesus Christ calls us to, and then let the God of history take those actions and use them in kingdom making. And sometimes at the end of my day, I like to think of God as taking the works that I have done, or the gifts that I have offered, or my little attempts at peacemaking, and kind of looks at them and blows, and the chaff goes all over, and there are a few little things left in God's hands, and God says, I really think I can use these things that you've done today. Most of it is just a bunch of nonsense. I really, there's maybe not a lot of use for much of what you do in the kingdom, but there are some little things here that I think I can use. And so that frees me up, that I don't have to change the world. I simply am called to do what my gifts call me to do, and let God take those things and use them, because peace is always a gift. It is a gift of God. God is the one that does the work. And we are called to follow the Prince of Peace and to be active where God is also working. I think God has a plan for shalom. The church has just often been very reluctant to endorse God's plan. And I think it's time that we reread again the Gospels and look very, very closely at our justifiable war tradition and the possibility that the Prince of Peace calls us into more of a pacifist position. All right, I told you there were three kinds of lies, the third being statistics, and so now I'm going to bombard you with some more statistics today. I just want to show you the enormity of our sin. Maybe if you close your eyes, well, no, you can't close your eyes because I want you to see some things. Once you were blind, now you can see. In all of World War II, the destructive power of all the bombs and weapons dropped by all of the people who were involved in the war came to 3,000 kilotons. The hydrogen bomb equaled 1,300 kilotons. Got that? One Russian SS-19 missile now has 5,000 kilotons, more than all of the destructive power used in World War II. Our Titan II missile has 10,000 kilotons. This is a Russian SS-18, and this is a Titan II missile that the United States has. One Russian SS-18 missile carries 10 nuclear warheads on it, and if we develop the MX, it will also have 10 nuclear warheads on it, meaning that when it strikes, it can go in at least 10 different directions. The MX missile, if you picture the destructive power, something like that, the hydrogen bomb destructive power comes to a little dot compared to the destructive power of the MX missile. The MX missile can go within 20 yards of its target. It can travel 1,500 miles, I guess. I've forgotten the exact statistics. 30 countries now have nuclear weapons, and it's estimated that by the end of the century, 100 countries will have produced and have the capacity to drop nuclear bombs. Both superpowers have strategic weapons. These are long-range weapons that can destroy huge areas, and both powers, superpowers, have tactical weapons, which are short-range weapons which don't destroy quite as much area. We have our weapons in three different places, in subs, on the ground, and in the air. Our submarines can cruise 100,000 miles without refueling, off of a little bit of fuel that's about the size of a tennis ball. There is no possible defense against submarines because there is no way of detecting where they are. The United States has 41 nuclear submarines, and we keep 20 in the seas at all times. Russia has 64 submarines, and they keep 10 in the sea at all times. The other third, or one-third, is of our missiles and our destructive power are in our submarines, which are impossible to detect. The other third is on the ground. Cruise missiles are other kinds of missiles. Cruise missiles, as I understand it, are the kind that can go underneath the radar and they can't be detected at all. ICBMs, which are multiple targetable reentry vehicles, meaning that there are many weapons on them, and when they hit, again, they can scatter. It's just not missile. Another third of our weapons, the last third, are carried on 400 bombers. They carry 2,500 nuclear bombs, and cruise missiles can also be carried by bombers, can be launched 1,500 miles from the target, can cruise under the radar to make detection impossible. The Soviets fit their bombs on about the same number of bombers, and they're called Bear and Bison bombers, but they also have about 400 bombers. Now, this is a lot of statistics, and it maybe doesn't mean a lot, but the first time I heard it and read it, I realized the enormity of what we were doing. We have the capacity to destroy every U.S. and Soviet city at least 35 together we have 15,000 nuclear bombs, but that's not enough. So each day we add in the United States 3 new bombs to our nuclear arsenal.
We should change the subject.
5 bombs to our nuclear arsenal.
How? Every day.
Every day.
Daily.
Do you still have that do you still have that sheet of paper that had the pacifist just war stance on it? Would you get that out and turn it over? Dan has a marvelous chart that he got out of Ruth Siebert's. It's the Megaton chart. Okay, there are 6,000 dots on here. Those of you that don't have it, can you see this? In the middle of the chart is one tiny dot. That is all the destructive weapons, the power that was detonated during World War II, or 3,000 kilotons. If you put a nickel, maybe you have a nickel, and you put it on the chart to cover 100 dots, that's the amount of nuclear weapons that would be needed to destroy all the major cities. And you notice what your nickel says.
Yeah?
The God you trust.
Right. I think it's every medium and large city in the world.
Every medium and large city.
Large city.
Down here, there's a little tiny circle that covers 8 dots or something. That's the destruction of the Trident submarine. So when John Nelson goes over the fence, he has reason to do that. The Poseidon submarine destructive power. But both of them carry more destructive power than all of the destructive power used in World War II. There simply is no defense. It is mutually assured destruction. But the fact that we have added a whole new list of words to our vocabulary, I didn't even know what these meant several years ago. Tactical nuclear warfare, first strike counterforce, credible first strike capability, winnability, survivability, striking second first, calculated preemption, balance of terror, reciprocal fear of surprise attack, mutually assured destruction. Does any of that sound like gospel vocabulary? I mean, it's just so far from what the Christian faith teaches that I don't understand how we have been pacifists, that kind of being passive. When our government presents a scenario of 2 million people being 20 million U.S. citizens being killed as acceptable, then you begin to wonder what the purpose of our government is. All right, now there are some ways that as Christians we can respond to threats upon us and the threat that we are to others. And this is going to sound like a Yoda review, but you ought to. Historically, there were ways of responding to the government. First, you had the Essene approach. What was that?
Withdrawal.
Withdrawal, okay. The Essenes went out into the desert to hide. If the government lets us worship at Holden Village and we get to use the LBW and we can have a formula of comfort and the Augsburg Confession in our library, it's okay. We'll simply, forget that. That was another option. Yes, okay, we can still do this by just simply putting our head in the sand and being passive. I'm talking about the Herodian option. Herodian Sadducee option. Yeah. Okay, they were the ones that kind of compromised. They wanted to bore from within. They said, the system is rotten, we don't like it, but we're going to stay in the system and try to do what we can. Okay, and this one I guess I would illustrate by the fact that you have Lutheran Social Services. You don't always work at changing the system, but you know it's a rotten system. Social service agencies. You send chaplains into the military to at least work on the spiritual needs of people. The Pharisee was another option. How do you spell Pharisee? I shouldn't even write on the board. I just can't spell. Pharisee option was the one I was talking about before. They were kind of, if you just let us alone, if you let us keep our own rules and regulations, worship the way we want to, have our own laws, we really won't bother you. You don't bother us, we won't bother you. We've got our own little sphere, you've got your own little sphere. So I think much of the Lutheran Church, as I see it, maybe is in this pharisaical thing. The last option was what Yoder talks about. The zealot option. And what does Yoder say? That he thinks as many as 5 of the disciples were zealots. They thought that the best way to go against the government that was a threat to them or that was oppressing them was to fight. So you have the flight option of the Essenes, the fight option of the zealots, the compromise of the Pharisees or the Herodians. And none of these really are a gospel option. The fifth one is one that Jesus probably had more trouble with the zealot option than any, meaning that it was very appealing to him. And I'm sure many of the disciples, and you probably got this from Yoder, felt that here was a man that was really going to lead them into battle, overthrow the government. And yet there is a fifth way, which is the Jesus option. The way of nonviolent suffering love. And Yoder says the only two ways that we are to imitate Jesus are what? There are only two ways that the New Testament calls us to be like Jesus, and it consistently does that over and over again. Maybe you haven't gotten that far, Yoder. It's dominion is replaced by servanthood, and cross as an example of self-giving love, love that absorbs hostility. So when someone is oppressing you and you think you have a right to strike back, it would be a very human, normal thing to just sock them, and they say, well, I know this person is evil, he just hit me, and the other person does. So he says, I'll hit him twice, so he gets socked twice, and the second person says, I knew it, I was absolutely right the first time, this guy is a rotten man, so you get out all the equipment you possibly can. And it goes on and on and on, both inflicting pain and suffering on the other person until someone is the winner. And then Jesus comes along and says, no. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And Clarence Jordan has a beautiful homily on this section of the Sermon on the Mount. He says, way back, even before the time of Moses and the prophets, if somebody hurt you or hurt your cattle, you could go out and you could just wipe them out. If they kicked you in the knee, you could cut their head off. If they killed your horse, you could kill all of their cattle. Just unlimited kind of revenge. And then, Jesus says, and the prophets came along, and Moses said, no, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You are to limit your revenge. If somebody knocks you in the mouth and knocks a tooth out, you're allowed just to knock his tooth out. If he knocks your eye out, you can just knock his eye out. You don't knock both eyes out. You limit the revenge. But then you've heard it said that you're to love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Here was this limited kind of love. It's all right. You ought to love those close to you and those who are your friends and those who can repay you. But then Jesus comes with this extremely radical statement of unlimited love. But I tell you to love your enemies, to pray for those who persecute you, and to do things to you that you don't want. Absolutely radical nature of the gospel of Jesus. Which, you know, I felt like last time I was talking to converted people or trying to convert already converted people, because I didn't sense that many of you were going to do argument with the fact that maybe the gospel of Jesus Christ calls us to nonviolent kind of love and to pray for our enemies. But when you really think about what that means in your life, it's a very, very radical, hard thing. And to me, It's all right if you don't believe that. I mean, it's not all right, but that's your privilege. But I wonder if you really don't have to look again at what Jesus, who is the Prince of Peace, calls us to do. There are some beautiful examples in Ron Sider's book. First of all, he talks about, Richard Taylor, who authored it, co-authored it with him, talks about his daughter, Debbie. And Debbie went out, they live in a community in Philadelphia, in an integrated area, in kind of a rough section of Philadelphia. Debbie, when she first moved in there and went to school, walked out of the door one day, and every day she would get hassled by this one girl. At school, she was called names, she had rocks thrown at her, she was pushed off the sidewalk. Debbie came home just in tears, and her parents said, "What's the matter?" And she explained what was happening to her at school. And they said, "Let's get together and talk about some ways that we can deal with this hostility and this anger and this violence that's being done to you." So they got down on the floor, big pieces of newsprint. And the first thing Debbie said was, "Well, I think I could probably hit her back, except she's bigger than I am, so maybe that wouldn't be such a good idea." And then she said, "Well, maybe I could go out the back door and go down the alley, and she wouldn't see me. I'll just avoid her." So they put "go down alley," you know. "Or, Mom, maybe you can take me to school in the car." Well, that's another option, so going to school in the car. "Or, I could call up my other friends and have them meet me here, and we could go as a big group. We'd be really scary if there were three or four of us." Okay, go in a group, you know. So they put all these options down, and Richard Taylor relates, he finally said, "Debbie, you forgot one thing. What about showing love to them, to her, and treating her as a human being?" And Debbie said, "I don't think that's a very good option. It won't work." She was very interested in the effectiveness approach. So she took the piece of paper, went back to her room that night. The next day, she had obviously thought about it. Came out the door, same thing. The girl met her there. "Hi, stupid. Boy, do you look dumb. Your socks don't even match your dress." And Debbie said, "Oh, my goodness, you're right. I got up so quickly, I didn't even see that they weren't matching. Boy, does your hair look ugly. It's the stupidest hairdo I ever saw in my life." And Debbie said, "Well, I really do need a friend to help tell me that. I didn't even realize how I look. You know, I don't have a mirror in my room and the bathroom's always busy. Thanks a lot, I'll go back in and take care of it." So she goes back in, comes back out again. "Hey, ugly, oh, do you really think I'm ugly? Well, how do you put your makeup on?" You know, or, well, this conversation. And the girl finally crossed the street and came over and said, "What's with you anyway?" And Debbie said, "Well, I really do mean it. I do need a friend." And from that time on, the relationship completely changed. They walked to school every day together. Debbie had absorbed that hostility, had taken it in upon her, had continued to experience the hurt, but didn't give back hurt in exchange. Or that beautiful picture in Gandhi, that scene where they're lining up the salt march and the line after line of white robed Indians go and are beaten down with clubs by the British soldiers, and the women come and carry back the ones that are injured, never inflicting damage on the other. And finally, by the middle of the afternoon, the British soldiers throw down their weapons and say, "We can't hit one more person. There is no way we can do that." And they were defeated in that afternoon by that nonviolent action. When we train for nonviolent protests in Washington, D.C. in the early 70s and late 60s, nobody said, "Now you're not going to get hurt." I mean, when you go and sign up to be part of the Army, the recruiting officer doesn't say, "You're not going to be hurt, I'll promise you that." You expect that you might even give your life, and that's all right. But somehow, when it comes to nonviolence or absorbing hostility, we somehow have to think that, well, but I really do have to protect myself. I'm not willing to give my life. I might get hurt if I behave nonviolently. John Yoder has a great book, "What Would You Do If?" You know, the old argument, but what would you do if somebody came in the house and was going to rape your grandmother or something, you know? What, you'd have to shoot him, obviously. Gene.
I was going to say that what helps me too in all of what you're saying is to make a distinction between your feelings and your actions. because I've known a lot of Christians who end up stuffing feelings and end up being more violent because they're not being used to it. But be able to say, I'll feel the anger, I'll feel the injustice, but also that I can choose how to act.
All right. And that's exactly what nonviolence is. It is not passiveness, passivity. It is going forward to confront the evil and the injustice, but to do it in other ways than with violence. There's a beautiful little Sufi story that I copied for a journal that the Order of St. Martin has, and it said, Jesus was walking down the street one day and a bunch of Israelites reviled him, called him names, and were very, taunting in the things that they said. And instead of retorting in an evil way or a violent or angry way, Jesus simply said prayers in their name and prayed for the people. And one of the people said to Jesus, don't you know that they're your enemy? How could you just not revile them when they reviled you? And Jesus reported to have said, I could give only what I had in my pocket. And to me, that's a way of, we talk about being servants without having servants' minds. We talk about trying to be nonviolent without having that sense of inside of ourselves. It's not something you can just do overnight. It's something that simply takes discipline and understanding and a new way of seeing. When Musty said there is no way to peace, peace is the way, that's exactly what that means. I don't know whether I'm going to be nonviolent in a violent situation. I frankly haven't had many times in my life when I've had to really see if that was how I was going to behave. I hope to God I can control my anger and have it come out in other ways than by being violent or striking back. All I have are the little day-to-day irritations with people in this community to see if I am a nonviolent person or not. And sometimes you don't give me enough cause to even test that out. We have a story in our book, Things That Make for Peace, about Quaker Dave. Have you heard this story? I don't want to repeat it if everybody knows it. It was a friend of ours that we met during the civil rights campaign in D.C. He had gone down with a black friend to the South to help integrate the lunch counters. And when he was there, sitting at the lunch counter with his black friend, which was breaking the ordinance of the town, he felt a knife in his back. And he turned around, faced his adversary, looked him right in the eye, and said, friend, whether you stick that knife into me or not is up to you, but either way, I want you to know that I love you. And the man, who was a white, redneck, angry, hateful person, at least from the way he looked, simply his hand began to shake, and he dropped the knife, and he turned around and ran out of the drugstore. Because he did not understand that power of love. And Dave really meant that when he said, friend, you cannot fake something like that. When Jesus was in Gethsemane and Judas came in, you remember what he said? Friend, that's how he started it. I don't think Jesus was saying friend through gritting teeth, knowing what Judas was going to do. I think Jesus honestly felt that here is another person created in God's image. Or Ananias, when God told him to go and minister to Paul, who was blind. Here Paul had been persecuting the church. Everything that Ananias stood for, Paul was against, or Saul. And so he goes to see Saul, and the first thing he says is, Brother Saul. You know, I don't think that was just a casual greeting. It's Brother Saul. But that kind of understanding that we are all brothers and sisters and committed to one another. Civilian-based defense as a possibility for this country has never been tried. It has been tried in other countries, namely Norway, Sweden, Denmark. They're all looking into it. There's a beautiful story during the World War II of the Nazis. When they took over Norway, they put in place of the government, a fascist named Quisling. He began by working on the teachers and insisted that all teachers teach the fascist doctrine, instill that kind of doctrine in the school children. Insider reports that 12 out of 14,000 Norwegian school teachers refused to sign the declaration or the oath that they would do this. They were shipped to concentration camps up in the northern part of Norway. They were made to do torturous exercise out in the snow. They refused to give up their stance of nonviolence or their stance of what they believed. Quisling couldn't do anything about it. They came back to great parades by the Norwegian people, and if you see people running around the village wearing paper clips, that was a sign of the resistance movement. Everybody wore a paper clip. The Nazis refused to let people wear paper clips, but the paper clips kept appearing because paper clips are very easy things to find, and it was a way of saying, we're with you, we want to stand in solidarity. Only 32 teachers gave in to the torture that was inflicted upon them by the Nazis. Two died of freezing, but they refused to back down, and Quisling finally said, you have ruined absolutely everything for me. You have destroyed the system that I've set out to be. The Norwegian people were amazing during World War II. All of the bishops and the clergy, with very few exceptions, when they were told what to preach in their churches, they refused to do it. When the churches were closed down, they held services at different times. Bishop Berggrave of Norway, one of the shining examples of a nonviolent church leader, was imprisoned, then put under house arrest because there was so much to do about it. The people were absolutely revolting. 12 Nazis were sent to guard the bishop. He so loved them and ministered to them nonviolently that they even made him a uniform of a police or a Gestapo so that he could go to Oslo and visit with some other church people and come back incognito. They loved him. They let him escape, and they let him tie them up so it looked like some other people had come in so they wouldn't be in trouble. A beautiful example of a man who simply won over his captors by showing love that Jesus had. Martin Luther King Jr. Again and again, preaching not to be violent, but to love your enemies and to pray for those. So when people say, well, that's all right, Gandhi just had the British to contend with, or Martin Luther King had a very good government to work with, that couldn't happen in Nazi Germany, I think Norway is a very good example. Or back in the mid-1800s, when Austria captured Hungary and did the same thing that the Nazis tried to do with the Norwegians. They resisted everything that the Austrians told them to do. When they said that their government couldn't meet, they met anyway. When they said their church leaders, especially the Lutherans, couldn't meet, the Lutherans got together anyway, standing 500 bishops strong and saying, come on in and take us, shoot us, whatever you do, we refuse to back down. They couldn't do anything because the will of the people and the power was there, and that power of love not to inflict any violence. Yeah, we might get hurt, but at least we are not going to have it on our conscience and on our soul that we have responded in kind. There are all kinds of examples that Sider gives, but I really liked when he said about the Hungarians too, that they refused to pay their taxes. And the Austrians said, all right, we'll just come in and take all your goods. They said, okay, take them. So here are the Austrians with just hundreds of housefuls of furniture and all of this stuff. It did them no good at all. So they said, okay, we're going to have an auction. Well, nobody agreed to be an auctioneer. They couldn't find any auctioneers in Hungary. All the auctioneers just suddenly weren't there. So they brought in Austrian auctioneers. So they had these big auctions, but nobody bid on anything. So here they said, they finally had to give everything back. There was nothing that they could do. But when at the first of this invasion, when the Hungarians had tried to fight back with arms for 10 years before they decided to do things nonviolently, there was much bloodshed, many people killed, and nothing was accomplished. So there are ways where we can maybe start to think that there are other things to do than how we have in the past responded. I'd like you to look at these. I don't know how good these questions are, but I would like you to look at these.
would like you to get in groups of four people and spend the next 15 minutes, not all or as important questions as some of them. You can pick out ones that appeal to you the most, but would you at least look at all of them, talk about all of them briefly, and maybe concentrate on one that is would you get in groups of four, please?
Thank you. Burning more, yeah. All that stuff there.
So what would I do? Amongst each other, we get in a peace march, you want to.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I sure is. I heard that.
So sorry, I just heard that. And I guess I always go back to the wounded.
Oh, I heard that.
So also, I was going to do.
I know, but I need to.
Like I saw.
It's not from here or else, yeah.
You do it as well.
Probably 76, probably.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of peace itself. The world is giving you a peaceful place.
Oh.
You're actually doing what you're trying.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Where we said it.
Yeah, it wasn't like.
On the medical.
Aren't you gonna get a medical? Well, I guess especially for. You know, somebody outside of our. I would not see Americans for a while.
If you were looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. And that we define. Seems like so often we assume.
In our choices.
Yeah, that's a simple.
Well, just. Well, it seems that we think our money says to get out of. Yes, for having to realize what I think is most of Jesus is. You know, realize. So I love that example. Some like pictures right there.
I've never seen a value in the church before I look at.
Okay, I'm. You want to get back in a big circle again, please? Okay. Didn't sound to me like there was much shattering. Too hard or too simple or too much. Okay. Okay, does anybody have anything that they want to say about this?
Reinhold's Quadrat.
Reinhold's Quadrat. Actually, I think Whole Politics of Jesus was written as a to counterbalance Reinhold, but I'm not sure. Do you agree with these? Are they your questions? Did I just hit things that are not the things that you've heard or that are not your questions?
I found it challenging my own belief in the power of love. I mean, you look at these questions and say, how do I answer these five questions? And where do I go with that? We've thought of examples like symbolism and Hitler, where there was evil. And do you allow the evil to continue and love, or do you strike out? And your own, what I found myself doing was my whole philosophy of loving my neighbor was challenged. And I can't right now love a Hitler. My response is to go get him.
Thank you for your honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the idea that the United States during the Second World War tried to stay out of it as long as we could? And I don't know what motivation that was for, but you know, but maybe if we'd gone into it a lot sooner, we would have prevented more people from dying.
That's what they said about the end of the law, too.
Yeah, I know.
That was our rationale for dropping the law.
Yeah.
That was a Russian.
That it would end if someone,
Jean?
That strikes me, the whole thought of the power of love too, is to think of, I think of an individual trying to work out of love as against a whole mass of people working out of violence, or at least in the structures of violence. But I thought, what if we had, you know, that whole, to see not as individuals, but as many people that are in armies working out of that power of love. And then, I mean, there's a whole different kind of transforming.
What if a whole country of people was trained in love power instead of military power? Is that absolutely impossible? Bill brought this up the other day. Is pacifism, does it have more to do with personal morality? The government is amoral, according to me, follows military necessity. Is that right? Are only individuals expected to be pacifists or to show a love ethic? Can we expect our government to do that?
I think our government has to represent the people, and that means that our people have to change, and then force the government to, you know, I mean, I think that our government will reflect the whole mentality.
Does the church reflect the mentality of the individual people? The institutional church? Would you say that the church to which you belong is amoral or is a moral church?
Amoral or a moral? I think it reflects the people. I mean, I'd like to say that no, it transcends the mentality of the people. But in reality, I think our churches are reflecting the people more than trying to transform them.
Then is the church the body of Christ?
Okay, now we're using different definitions of church. I was thinking of the church institution, and now you're talking about the church as the
people. Okay, is the church as an institution the body of Christ?
Most of the churches I've come in contact with would not say they are.
Would not say they are?
Right.
You would not say they are, or they
right.
say...
Oh. Right.
Dan?
Well, you can have a diseased body. A disorganized, sick body.
I think we could expect the government to be a government of love. It seems that that's what the Civil Rights Act was after. That we're trying to say a government ought to be, and we ought to follow a rule of love and acceptance, and not separateness like we've been doing. So we'll institutionalize that, and even if not everybody thinks that way, we will.
So you think you could legislate love?
I think I can expect the government to try to lead that and make decisions. I'm not saying I expect that I believe our government is capable of doing that, but I would like to expect that of a government. David.
And Richard, I was just going to say something to answer your question about the churches. Well, what Dan said, I think that if this is your sole criteria for it, is the church the body of Christ, then no, but there are certain other things. That is really the body of Christ, so in that sense, the church is a disease body.
Well, I would say, I think that Judy is saying you can legislate morality. People always say that you can't legislate morality, but I don't think that's accurate, because I think the civil rights legislation was an example of that, which instituted norms in our society that now a generation of people have grown up with. And it's, I think, the morality of our children in regard to racial issues, while not perfect, is vastly different than it would have been had not the laws forced immigration, forced more equal and where that leads me to is, but I think a very good case can be made now for the practicality of pacifism or of non-cooperation, aside from the gospel basis for it, that our technology has forced us, in my opinion, to make radical changes in the way we relate to one another, whether we're Christians or not, whether we buy the philosophy of love, the philosophy of non-cooperation or something, it's more and more practical as our as military looks more and more impractical and ludicrous even to military people.
So why are we adding 5 bombs to our arsenal every day?
Well, it hasn't won a majority view. I don't think it's
getting done.
I mean, I speak to scientific holders. The peace movement of today as opposed to 5 years ago, which is amazing.
Do the rest of you sense that with people on the outside? Well, Holden is not a good example. I seem to feel there's a majority opinion here that it's not the same as everybody else, Jane.
I was just something.
Okay, go ahead. I don't
forget that. It's a yes, I'll see you change. What I was going to say was, to Bill, is there a difference between illuminating legislation that is immoral and legislating morality? I mean, there were laws that blacks couldn't go here and they had to go there. I'm getting rid of those laws. And on the other hand, you can't necessarily. And then as far as power, and Yoder's stance is that Christians living out the gospel can't be in power, can't be around just standing. Isn't that what he came
to say? The last thing I was
thinking of that Christians living out the gospel can't be in power. Because in order to be in power,
listening to National Public
someone said, what do you think about the fact that you're standing here with the ability to destroy millions of people? And they said, oh, we don't think of that. You can't see them. We push a button. You put on a uniform. It's just like working at McDonald's. You just put on a uniform, you go to work, and if you have to push a button, you do. I mean, there is no thinking, and I suppose you really can't if you were in that situation, but the enormity of what we are doing.
No, I don't think that. I think that's true. I think they don't think about killing any individual person. It's just a...
It's a job to do, and we've been told to do it. Idol, Dan makes such a beautiful point of the arms race as idolatry, and I guess maybe I should have started with that instead of ending with that. But do you realize that the New Testament talks about idolatry more than anything else? More than sin, grace, heaven, hell, any of those doctrinal terms that we throw out. Idolatry is the main issue, followed by economic issues. There are more verses in the New Testament concerned with idolatry and then economic issues than anything else. And idolatry not in the sense of little gold statues that you rub their tummy when you go by, but all of those things in which we put our security. You only possess those things which after your house and garage burned down you still have. Those are the only things that really should matter or that you really do possess. Our security in our material possessions, our security in our militarism is idolatry. And Dan points out in By Faith Alone that idols ask us to make sacrifices. I said last time that we're being asked to pay $1.7 trillion in the next 5 years. $1.7 trillion. That's $4,000 a year for every household in the United States of four people. $4,000 a year to defend ourselves. We sacrifice the lives of men and women in war. 55,000 American men were killed during the Vietnam War. Since the Vietnam War, 55,000 men have committed suicide. As many servicemen have committed suicide following the Vietnam War as were killed in the Vietnam War, and 30,000 are in penal institutions, federal and state penal institutions. Now that is a sacrifice of human life for something that didn't even fit under the justifiable war criteria. The money, the minds of industry and of science that goes into developing weapons that could be put into curing African sleeping sickness or river blindness, whatever that term is that I forget the name of it, that takes the lives and disables so many African children. I mean, such, when I told about the 3% of that military budget that could be taken and what could be done in the next 5 years, it's just overwhelming to me. An idol promises something that cannot deliver. It promises salvation. And if it's an idol, it's no good. It says, I'm making a promise, but it can never follow through. And that's exactly what the nuclear arms race is. We have never developed weapons that we have not used. Russian playwright Chekhov, is that how you pronounce his name? Says, if you hang a weapon on the wall of the first act, you always have to make sure it's used by the third act, by the end of the play. There are no winners. There is no defense. War is not the lesser of two evils. No war is the lesser of two evils. I do not believe that God ever calls upon us to make a choice between just evil things. There are other ways of dealing with evil than being evil ourselves. What about the Russians? How do you witness to someone that God loves them except by being love yourself? You can't look an enemy in the eye and say, God loves you, bang, bang, you're dead. Or God loves you and I've got this MX missile or this Trident submarine that's going to blow you off the face of the earth if you don't believe it. And it just does not make sense. We are not told to love our enemy, Euler says, because our enemy is nice or lovable. They wouldn't be our enemy if they were nice and lovable. They are probably rotten people. But we are told to love our enemy because, and we are to do that because God commands us to do it. It's simply a command of God. We are to love and pray for our enemies. After the Civil War, an old story, I'll say it again because it fits. Thaddeus Stevens was in Lincoln's cabinet, and when Lincoln was talking about reconciliation with the South and how to reconstruct the South and how to do good to those people, Thaddeus Stevens was incensed, and he pounded on the table and said, "Mr. President, I think enemies are to be destroyed." And Thaddeus Stevens said, "Don't I destroy my enemy when I make him my friend?" And that's exactly what happens, I think, when we begin to love our enemies and to pray for them. Idolatry. We need prophets who are willing to stand up and to be unpopular and say, "This is sin, it is wrong. How can you call yourself a Christian church or a Christian person and continue to build weapons to threaten or to use weapons to destroy our enemy?" It is a radical, unpopular, heretical, traitor-sounding thing to say in the United States today, but I want to continue to be a prophet and to stand up and point out to people the enormity of our sin and what we are doing and call people to repentance, not leave everybody with a guilt trip and say, "Oh, my own sin, my most grievous sin, how could I do this?" But to start being active love makers. And Dan is very nicely put together some things that we handed out to these LC workshops last summer. 40 ways to work for peace. And if you put down your handwork for me, like you just in closing, to read over those things and prayerfully and thoughtfully mark 5 things that you're not already doing that you could do, and then maybe put a star by one thing that you'd like to commit your life to as far as peacemaking is concerned. Are there enough to go on? Has never been in focus.
If I decide not to pay my American income taxes, which is what would they do? Come up to Canada and take my pension?
It depends. depends on how much you're withholding. Dan and Karen get their money jerked out of the bank every year. Dan and Karen are war tax resisters by refusing to pay a certain percentage of them. They will charge 20% interest on what you do not pay. They will come and take it out of your bank account. They have a right to do that. I'm sure they can. Nobody has ever been put in jail for war tax resistance. I'm not talking about tax evasion.
I'd be curious about it.
If they could go to Canada?
If the IRS can go to Canada to...
Well, I know they have a reciprocal agreement. I'm just wondering, because I got married last year, my tax has also gone up, which it doesn't in Canada. But it's gone up $400.
It's your penalty.
Yeah, it's true.
It's like the apartheid.
I happened not to be married before, and all of a sudden now because I'm married, the Americans want $400 more than they did before, you know? So I considered lying and saying that I'm still single, but they have to get my Canadian first one, so
the thing to do about that is make sure that you tell as many people as you can.
Well, I definitely do that.
That you write letters and you send them to a lot of people. That's probably one of the biggest steps on here for people to take, is to consider to be a conscientious objector by not paying a portion of your war taxes.
I should try this.
Just write a letter and say why you're not.
No, I don't think there's a federal government that's for my money, but not a North Dakota state government wants my money for the last 4 or 5 years. Simply a way of being faithful, if that's how you choose to be faithful. You say, Here I stand, I'm not going to, this is where I draw the line. And I think the effectiveness in the fact that the bankers know that you're opposing war, that the secretary who has to let the IRS into your vault, or the Congress people that you send a letter to, or the IRS official, or a group of people that you talk to about it, that's all a way of saying, I'm concerned, and my conscience will not let me pay this tax. And it's scary, because as Yoder said, we are used to keeping rules, and our identity is bound up with a lot of rule keeping, and it's kind of scary to think that we might be breaking some kind of law. Well, it's growing and growing. There is a group that is waiting to get 20,000, isn't that the figure, Dan?
Yeah.
20,000 tax resistors, and when they do, all of these people have said, we'll continue to pay our taxes, but when you get 20,000 people, we'll stop. And they're going to all, in 1 year, 20,000 people are going to refuse to pay their taxes, and it's just more than the bureaucracy and the computers could possibly handle, because they all have to be audited.
So.
Write to Tom and ask him how you do that.
I would.
Yeah.
I don't think I was audited. I just tell him, I fill it out in a normal way and tell him I'm not paying 36%.
get a day in court if you want it. Dan and Karn's experience up here was when they were told that they should appear in court in Seattle, I guess. You know, I think I should let Dan tell us. I think he just wrote and said
it wasn't a court, it was to appear in the IRS office.
Oh.
And talk for counsel.
No, we knew what we were doing. We broke the law. We're willing to pay the consequences. That's your revolutionary subordination, Jane.
But they gain 20% and they end up getting more.
Right. And there is not a good place to stand on this. It is simply, and that's the argument that many people have. In essence, what you're doing is giving the government more. I just think there's got to be a way to stop this. And if enough people continue to do that, even though they're going to take more, it's going to be such a hassle. I mean, it really does cost the government a lot of money.
It's a lot of administrative work. You know, I dealt with it. We get, I bet it costs 20%. They're just sending out letters and letters and letters.
Getting lawyers.
And it occurs to me that it would be really good if we could be in touch with the secretary of the bank, who has to open the vault for whoever it is. I mean, to go, like in a small town like Bill's, and to go down and say, I'm sorry, this causes a little more work, but this is why it's happening. To have that contact with those people, or even if we know IRS people, you know, whatever. Because the 20% extra goes towards that, and it's those people that probably are mad at the stupid tax paid, you know, resistors.
They just get a simple little letter from the IRS saying, who's that official being on this person's bank account? You get a check for this. 30-second proposition. So.
But still, they're involved.
Right,
I mean,
and that's
the
way it's spreading this.
Right. It's not a hassle for them. Right.
But I wouldn't want the teller thinking that I was just an invader of my taxes. I want the teller who I go to church with or go to a garden club with or whatever to know why I was doing this. I really think that's important.
And with the IRS sent an official lien to almost every bank in town, and the one that I normally bank at last is the one I've paid my checks on the IRS, so that every bank in town
knows
why we're in trouble with the IRS. I don't know why they should just check the one that they have another check.
Okay, well, if this is at all makes you think of some ways, and I would think that would be worthwhile. Don't just throw it in this paper basket, but put it in a journal if you keep one or something. Okay, thank you. Oh, Bill has some extra resources.
Obviously, this is an issue I've been dealing with for a while. I want to recommend a couple more things. I mentioned the other day that Douglass's theology,
nonviolent
cross, was real crucial for me. But I think after I said that it wouldn't be the first book I'd recommend. Yeah, did you bring that?
Yeah. Is that
additional?
Well, I gave him a book to read. The one that I'd really recommend as a basis for Christians, and it's really easy to read, it's got big print, it just kind of covers the text, no pictures. It's called
Perhaps.
The New Testament Basis
for Peacemaking.
New Testament Basis for Peacemaking. And it's by Richard J. McSorley, McSorley.
It's not a book.
It deals with the New Testament arguments for war and the different passages that have been used to justify war, and then he explains how that has been misinterpreted. It deals with what about war in the Old Testament? What about the first three centuries of the Christian church, which was entirely pacifist? Just really, really well laid out.
It's where those questions come from.
New Testament basis for
peacemaking. Sure, and it's published by a little, I think maybe published itself. It's difficult to get involved.
It's still in print.
I got some just a couple months ago. And then a resource that has incredible credibility. The Center for Defense Information is a group primarily of retired military officials. It's headed up by Admiral Gene Barak. And they put out a newsletter Okay, 823 United Nations Plaza. 823. Just can't hear without her glasses. Suite 207. New York City 10164. And if you send them a $25 contribution, they'll send you the newsletter. And it's got really solid facts and figures. They're called to testify before Congress all the time. They put out the movie War Without Winners, which you may not have seen in the next few days. But for the people who say, I mean, they're really good resources for the people who are hard to convince. They say, well, Admiral Iraq, throw an admiral in front of something, you know, people are going to pay attention. The recent issues have dealt with the ludicrousness of civil defense systems, of civil defense planning.
People that since we've come back, I think that there is, we could tell the difference of